Okay, back to work. Are there any questions? Let me just basically run over this again one more time, very simply. Plaintiff's recovery from the defendants is reduced by the plaintiff's negligence. If plaintiff has $100,000 in damages and plaintiff is 60% negligent, his recovery is reduced by 60% or $60,000, leaving a recovery of $40,000. The plaintiff is entitled to recover this $40,000 from either or both of the defendants. The defendants are jointly and severally liable for this entire $40,000. Okay? Now, if one defendant pays the entire $40,000, that defendant is entitled to a right of contribution from the other defendant in the amount of $20,000 in general cases, because that is the pro rata share of liability, determined without regard to fault. Pro rata generally means one half in the case of two defendants, one third in the case of three defendants. This is the case regardless of the comparison of negligence between the defendants. If one defendant was 5% negligent and the other was 35% negligent, the $40,000 is still 40,000 paid by one, the other he's entitled to right of contribution for 20,000. Okay, are there any questions on this? Because it's possible that you might get a calculation to run through. Number one, repeat it again. Plaintiff's recovery is reduced by the plaintiff's percentage of fault. Contribution is determined between the defendants without regard to fault. Indemnity has nothing to do with contribution. A right of indemnity would be available to you either under the principles of common law in some jurisdictions, although we don't have any cases on this here. The ordinarily negligent defendant would be entitled to indemnity from the grossly negligent defendant or from the defendant who did something intentionally. There are also indemnity contracts, which is a situation in which indemnity comes up more commonly, between contractors and subcontractors, and landowners. There is a case which we've cited in the supplement to you on that subject. That's the case of, 1 minute here. Case of City and Borough of Juneau, cited on page 3, versus the Alaska Electric Light and Power Company, and that deals with the subject of contractual indemnity provisions. And if they offer different measures than the Alaska Contribution Among Joint Tortfeasors Act, they still are enforceable. Yes? Okay, well, the defendant then would counterclaim against the plaintiff. And then for the purpose of comparative negligence, then you would assign liability to, well, let's take a simple case, to one plaintiff versus one defendant, $100,000 damage to each, well, say $100,000 to the plaintiff, $50,000 to the defendant, 60-40 negligence, 60% to the plaintiff, 40% to the defendant. Since the defendant was 40% negligent, he would have to pay 40% of the plaintiff's recovery, he'd have to pay $40,000. On the counterclaim, the defendant would be treated just like he was the plaintiff. And since the plaintiff was 60% negligent, the plaintiff would have to pay 60% of the defendant's damages, which would be $30,000. It's exactly the same rule if you're familiar with the rule of comparative negligence in admiralty, if you've had that in law school. Pure comparative negligence is exactly the same as you see in admiralty cases. Yes? I'm trying to think of a case. I haven't seen that. Generally, as a practical matter, they're treated as set-offs, and I think that's the result you'd get to. Although, if you got a special, this is one of these things where hard cases make different types of law. And if you did get to an insurance company case where you got a special result and badly injured plaintiffs, you might get a different result up by the, up in the Supreme Court. I don't know the answer to that one for certain. I don't think it has been answered. We do have joint and several liability up here. I think we've talked about that quite a bit. Joint liability and several liability, each of two joint tortfeasors is responsible for all the damage. One special case, Nicholas versus Moore, where, well, actually two special cases. One member of a hunting duo is not liable for the negligence of his co-hunter. A person who was injured through storekeeper's negligence and slip and fall, and who was then subsequently further injured by negligent operation of the city's ambulance. Those were two separate torts, and there was not joint and several liability in that type of situation. Where there is a situation, which is the standard one, where you have three people out hunting, and they all shoot a rifle generally in the direction of the plaintiff, and one of them manages to shoot the plaintiff's testicle off, which is an actual Alaskan case, and you don't know who did it, then there is joint and several liability. Okay, let's back up. I've got some great cases with great... I had a friend back in law school who... we had several names for him, but one of the things he did, he collected dirty cases. And if he'd run across them in the case books, he'd Xerox them, and he had just a huge collection of these. Okay, products liability. Products liability is the most important area on the bar exam, and if I were to lay down a substantial amount of money on what subject you're going to be facing on the bar exam, I would say it's going to be products liability. The reason that I say it's products would be products liability is that recently it's always been products liability or some aspect of it. There's no reason for the Bar Association to change, because good questions can be written in the products liability area. In preparation for the tort question, I would suggest that you take a look through the past three exams that I've passed out to you and look at the tort questions that you have on those exams. That's the type of tort question that you will probably get on this exam. Unfortunately, the Alaska Bar Association does not publish model answers to the exam. There's one break that you get if you fail the bar exam, and that's that you can go in and you can look at answers of students who've written good answers and students who've written bad answers. And I've done this, not because I failed it, but on behalf of students who have failed it. And I can't tell the difference between a good answer and a bad answer, according to the Alaska Bar Association. So anyway, other than that, good luck. But the best way... I don't know. The method is not statistically very reliable, though. The Supreme Court is going to have an opportunity to rule on it if they want to. Some of the people from the last bar examination have that question up before them. They have another question up before them which is interesting, too, and that's whether or not it's a denial of equal protection to allow you to carry over your multi-state score from another state and not to carry over your California essay score if you took the bar exam down in California and you're going to take exactly the same bar exam up here. That's another one that they'll have a shot at. But anyway, let's go back to products liability. Look at the products liability question on the exam that I passed out to you. Read it for reference also to the civil procedure issues. By the way, there's one question which was asked on the evidence, which I'm not sure if it was hit in any lectures, but it's something you should be aware of. And that's the fact that many municipalities in the state of Alaska have provisions in their municipal charters that say you cannot bring an action against the municipality unless you file a claim with the city clerk within 4 months after the date of the accident. The Alaska Supreme Court has held that these limitation clauses are void as being in conflict with the state statute relating to general limitations on tort actions. The state has set a policy. Statute of limitations on all tort actions is 2 years, and the municipalities cannot set themselves out as separate classes of defendants by trying to shorten the statute of limitations, because that's in direct contravention to state policy. The decision is based on conflict with state statute and limitations placed on home rule cities. rather than on equal protection arguments. The equal protection issue, as far as creating different classes of defendants, was raised but never reached by the Supreme Court. Okay, back to products liability. We start with the Clary versus Fifth Avenue Chrysler Center in 1969. Basically, the rule is no different than you have in California. As a matter of fact, the Alaska Court adopted the California rule as set forth in Greenman. In Alaska, a manufacturer is strictly liable in tort when an article he places on the market, knowing it is to be used without inspection for defects, proves to have a defect that causes injury. That's basically the rule of Greenman and Clary versus Fifth Avenue Chrysler. Okay, now they specifically state in Buckner versus Pearson that strict liability in tort has only to do with the existence of the defect in a product. You do not get to negligence concepts at all. And on the bar exam, in previous bar exams, the products liability question has asked you to discuss it in terms of products liability and do not discuss it in terms of negligence. You know, but be aware that there are two wholly different areas. You have products liability, where the liability is predicated upon the existence of a defect and defect causing injury, and that's all. You also have an independent action for negligence, even though the independent action for negligence is almost often not brought as a practical matter because it's so much easier to show what's required under defective product, i.e. existence of defect and injury. Under the negligence, you would have to show, you wouldn't show defect and injury. What you'd have to show is that the manufacturer was negligent, that the what the negligence was, that the negligence proximately caused the accident, that type of thing. It's a much harder burden of proof. But remember that that is available to you as a cause of action for the purpose of bar examination questions. Okay, as you go on down, you get to Boutade versus Suburban Marine and Sporting Goods Incorporated in 1975. Now, that's the most important case in the history of the state of Alaska in the law of personal injury products liability. In Boutade, Suburban Marine and Sporting Goods, Inc. furnished a snow machine to Boutade. Boutade rode the snow machine, allegedly did not properly maintain the snow machine. It did not properly oil it, do the maintenance that was required on it. And as a result of either the snow machine being defective or his not properly taking care of it, he was injured. Okay, the court held that the plaintiff does not have to prove that the product was unreasonably dangerous and that the plaintiff was aware of the defect. Unreasonably dangerousness and awareness are not relevant. The only things that the plaintiff has to prove is to go back to the Greenman formulation. Number one, the product is defective. Number two, the defect in the product was the proximate cause of the injury to the plaintiff. Those are the only things that the plaintiff has to show for a product strict liability and tort product liability case. Okay. Now, as far as plaintiff's contributory action to his injury, prior to Boutade, contributory negligence, or whatever the plaintiff did, was a defense to a product's liability action only where the plaintiff voluntarily and unreasonably encountered a known risk. Now, the only thing is whether or not the plaintiff's own conduct contributed in some way to his injury. That's the only thing you have to consider, whether or not the plaintiff's own conduct, whatever it was, contributed in some way to its injury. The defense is not limited to those cases where the plaintiff knew about the defective condition or did anything particularly bad. It's just simply, what is it that the plaintiff did? Did the plaintiff do anything that might have contributed to his injury? Day versus Sturm Ruger is kind of an interesting case, which is also on the borderline of whether what the plaintiff did was contributory negligent or not. The plaintiff Day was unloading a Sturm Ruger revolver while sitting under the wheel of a pickup truck with a very small cab. During the process of unloading the revolver, he dropped it, grabbed it, and managed to shoot himself in the leg. The majority of the Supreme Court held that this conduct, which might have contributed to his injury, was sufficient to take the question of comparative negligence to the jury. Simply dropping the weapon might have been sufficient for the jury to have determined some comparative negligence. There was a dissent there which held that that simply was not conduct, which as a matter of law could have been comparatively negligent. But basically, the rule is whatever plaintiff's own conduct might be, if it could have contributed to the accident, the jury is entitled to consider it and determine whether or not comparative fault should be applied. That's products liability in the personal injury area. Products liability in the economic loss or property damage case starts with the case of Morrow versus New Moon Homes. And it also starts with Morrow and Cloud versus Kit Manufacturing Company, which are two types of cases dealing with the same type of product. And they're the leader of a line of cases which leads up to the present date, even to the supplement. And they deal with strict liability in tort where the result is not personal injury, but the result is property loss. Now, in Morrow versus New Moon Homes, the plaintiffs had a trailer which was, it could be classified as a lemon trailer. The trailer was, you know, like a lemon automobile. You get one where the engine doesn't work. Well, anyway, the trailer leaked and nothing worked, and it generally deteriorated very fast. In Cloud versus Kit Manufacturing Company, there was a defect in the trailer. The defect was in the furnace of the trailer, and the defective furnace caused the trailer to burn up. Okay, now in Morrow, the court held that where the trailer, they used broad language in Morrow and talked about economic loss in that type of situation not being covered by strict liability in tort. That strict liability in tort does not extend to the consumer who suffers economic loss only. That this now don't write this down because this has been this was a broad statement which in more modern cases as you go along has been severely cut back. Okay, the reasoning of the court there was that the plaintiff had to go under implied warranty. Okay, then you get Cloud versus Kit Manufacturing, and the plaintiff, the defendant trailer manufacturer says, well, you said in Morrow that strict liability does not apply to economic loss only, and this guy lost his trailer just like the guy in Morrow did. There was economic loss, strict liability and tort doesn't apply. Supreme Court said no, and distinguished Morrow by saying that in Morrow, the trailer was a lemon, I think they even used the word lemon, which was not suited for the purpose for which it was purchased, whereas the product in Cloud did have a defect in it, which could be identified, and the defect caused sudden harm. The distinction was made between economic losses in Morrow, because it was a lemon which deteriorated, and direct property damage, and stated that sudden and calamitous damage, which takes place very quickly, almost results in direct property damage, and things like deterioration, breakage, depreciation, that type of thing, is considered economic loss. Okay, then, from there we go to the supplement. The Supreme Court found, when the next case came down the pike, that that wasn't a good rule either. Okay, the next case in that particular area that comes down the pike is Northern Power versus Caterpillar Tractor. That's a case in the supplement, page 5. Okay, now Northern Power versus Caterpillar Tractor had an engine which was furnished by Caterpillar Tractor, which had a defective low oil pressure shutoff system in it. And the low-pressure oil shutoff system failed, which caused the engine to seize and destroyed the engine. Clearly, this is sudden and calamitous direct property loss because there's a defect in the engine. The Supreme Court again here backed away from the sudden and calamitous occurrence as being the dividing line and said And this is probably a rule that you should memorize here, or at least write down and go into the exam knowing the criteria, that when a defective product creates a situation potentially dangerous and loss occurs as a result of that danger, strict liability and tort is an appropriate theory of recovery, even though the damage is confined to the product itself. Okay, now in order to recover on that theory, the plaintiff has to show two things. Number one, that the loss was a proximate result of the dangerous defect. And number two, that the loss occurred under the kind of circumstances that made the product a basis for strict liability. Now, number two is really a very interesting standard, and I don't know exactly how good it is, but I think we're going to get some more cases to find out what that means. That the loss occurred under the kind of circumstances that made the product a basis for a strict liability. And what happened in this particular case, the court held that this wasn't appropriate, that the loss was economic rather than property damage, and that strict liability and tort didn't apply. Now, they discussed the possibility of one component part of a product damaging another component part of the product, and ducked that question in this case, saying that the argument might have some validity if the one component part were manufactured by one manufacturer and the second component part were manufactured by another manufacturer. However, here the items were put together and sold as a package, and the one component part damaging the other component part argument is inapplicable. Okay, now let's go back. We've worked our way, I think, through all of the property damage, strict liability, and tort cases. But follow your way through Morrow, Cloud versus Kit, and Northern Power Engineering versus Caterpillar Tractor, and be familiar with the way that this case law has grown and the way it's likely to grow in the future. Let me go back again to personal injury property damage. Certain special things about defect. Important case, Caterpillar Tractor versus Beck, which is cited on page 17. Caterpillar Tractor versus Beck set the definition of defect in the state of Alaska. There are a number of theories or a number of things. There are about five different approaches to what it is that makes a product defective. In the state of Alaska, the court followed the formulation set forth in Barker versus Lowell Engineering Company in California. I'm not sure if this was discussed in your torts lecture, but I'm pretty sure that it would be. It's a formulation that's used in California. There's a two-prong test in Alaska for whether a product is defective. This test applies both to a manufacturing defect, which is a defect which occurs during the process of making the product, and a design defect, which is, again, self-explanatory. The product is designed improperly. It's not something which occurs during the making of it, but it's something which is inherently wrong with the product. Two-prong test as follows. Number one, a product is defectively designed if it fails to perform as safely as an ordinary consumer would expect when used in an intended and reasonably foreseeable manner. Okay, this one's easy. Okay, second is a risk-utility balancing analysis. The product can perform. This is a sort of a kind of hard one to get to. But the product can perform in accord with consumer expectations, but can still have excessive preventable danger inherent in the product. Examples again, I guess. The knife is a simple example of the one end of the risk-utility-benefit analysis. A knife is good for cutting things, but it's inherently sharp, and people will cut themselves with knives. But the benefit, a knife is no good if it's not sharp. So the risk-utility-benefit analysis there is if you want to have a knife and you want to have the benefits of being able to cut things, the knife has to be sharp. So simply because you're a manufacturer of knives, and it's inherent in designs of knives that knives are going to be sharp, that the analysis preponderates in favor of the manufacturer clearly. You're not liable strict liability and tort simply because you put a knife on the market, the knife has a defect because it's sharp, and a plaintiff cuts himself on it. Okay, the opposite end is Caterpillar Tractor versus Beck. where you put a Caterpillar tractor on the market which does not have a safety device, which is called a rollover protective system, or a ROPS bar. Beck was killed when his Caterpillar tractor rolled over on him. There was substantial discussion over whether or not these things were available at the time, but there were protective devices which could be put on the Caterpillar tractor, which would protect the driver in the event that the Caterpillar tractor rolled over. In this particular case, there was substantial evidence that the protective device may even have prevented the Caterpillar tractor from rolling over. Substantial disagreement over whether or not rollover protective devices were available. However, it was pretty much conceded that the falling object protective devices were available and used generally in the logging industry to protect the people driving the Caterpillar tractors in the forests from trees and branches and things falling on top of them when they were operating the Caterpillars. Okay, to get back to the two-prong test, though. In order to satisfy the two-prong test, number one, the first test, the plaintiff need only show that he was injured and that the injury was caused by the product's design. Okay, then you get to the second prong, the risk utility analysis, which the manufacturer has to show. And in order to avoid liability, the manufacturer has to show by a preponderance of the evidence, and the Supreme Court is very careful to use the word preponderance of the evidence, implying a somewhat different standard. It may imply a somewhat different standard, not necessarily, but to use the word preponderance of the evidence, that on balance, the benefits of the design outweigh the risks involved in the design. And this requires consideration of the dangers of the design, as well as the feasibility and costs and adverse consequences and alternative designs which might be available. You know, everything which might go into a risk-benefit analysis. What the benefit of the design is, alternatives, costs, that type of thing. Special rule here in Caterpillar versus Beck, where the defect in the design is a lack of a safety device, then you get back to the plaintiff may be comparatively negligent in knowing use of the defective product only if he voluntarily and unreasonably encounters the risk. There you get back to the special rule. Safety device, where the defect is a lack of safety device, then the plaintiff has to knowingly use the product voluntarily and unreasonably, encountering the known risk. Couple of other special cases. Last case, July 10th, 1981, the last case in the supplement dealing with warnings which can be attached or by the manufacturer to the product. The sufficiency of a warning is expressed without reference to negligence principles, as is logical because products liability and tort strict liability has nothing to do with negligence. And the thing which must command the attention of the jury is the adequacy and the necessity for the warning. Kind of an interesting evidentiary question, by the way, in this case, and that's that you cannot introduce testimony that the mother of an injured child had been a prostitute, because that's just too prejudicial. It was introduced for the theory that because the mother engaged in prostitution, that she would not properly supervise the child, which resulted in the child being burned by an electric heater. Just too far-fetched. The Supreme Court just reversed and remanded that one for a new trial. It also talks about the standard for expert witnesses in Alaska, which is far different than the standard for expert witnesses in other states. In Alaska, almost anyone can be an expert. All that the jury has to be able to do is receive appreciable help from that particular person on a particular subject. Most commonly, state troopers are asked to testify as to what was the cause of the accident, and they're sufficiently expert enough in order to testify as to what caused the particular traffic accident. Accident reconstruction experts are much preferable, of course, but accident reconstruction experts cost a lot of money, and sometimes it's just not worth doing it. Excuse me? Oh, no, all police officers. I just use state troopers as an example. Any person who can give appreciable help to the jury on the particular subject which is before the jury is entitled to be an expert witness. The expert witness, there There is a break, which is the expert witness can testify as to conclusions of fact, i.e., what caused the aircraft accident. It's the expert witness cannot testify as to the ultimate conclusions which are to be made by the jury, i.e., is Widmeyer versus Southeast Skyways. The expert can explain why the air crash occurred. The expert cannot explain whether or not the pilot was negligent because the air crash occurred, because that's within the province of the jury. I suppose the expert can say it was pilot error. But, you know, it's very hard. The expert can say why it happened, but the expert cannot assess negligence on the part of any party, because that's what the jury is supposed to do. Two more cases in the area of products liability, which are basically simple and straightforward. Products liability applies only to the sale of products. Products liability does not apply, strict liability and tort, does not apply to the furnishing of services. The simplest case in this area is the case on page 1 of the supplement, Swanson Trucking versus Truck Weld. In services, an action for negligent repair or negligent furnishing of the services is available, but strict liability and tort does not apply, because strict liability applies to the sale of products only and not to the performance of services. Going on through the outline, page 19, I think I lied to you a little bit. It'll probably be about quarter after 9. Page 19, bailment. One special thing to remember, the case of Burgess Construction versus Hancock. If property which is bailed or given to another party for safekeeping or turned over to another party is lost, all that the plaintiff has to do is show bailment and damage to the property, i.e., that he gave the property to the defendant in a particular condition and it was returned in a damaged condition. After that's done, the burden is upon the defendant to prove how the accident happened, produce evidence showing that he exercised care in protection of the property. The rationale for this is that the person who has the property is in the better position of explaining what happened to the property while it was in his possession. Okay, defamation, libel and slander cases. Libel and slander, I'll just run through. A lot of cases are set forth in the outline, but just let me run through how constitutionally libel and slander is treated in the state of Alaska. Okay, we start with the case of New York Times versus Sullivan. New York Times versus Sullivan, a U.S. Supreme Court case, which you would have had in con law, talks about public officials being unable to recover damages from media defendants unless the statement which is published by the media defendant is known by the media defendant to be false, or the media defendant acts in reckless disregard as to the truth or falsity. Okay, New York Times versus Sullivan extends protection to public officials. New York, called the New York Times rule. Okay, Curtis Publishing Company versus Butts, another U.S. Supreme Court case, extended the New York Times rule from public officials to public figures. Following that, a case called Rosenblum versus Metro Media, U.S. Supreme Court, extended the public official, public figure protection of the New York Times versus Sullivan case to private persons if the statements deal with matters of public concern. Okay, then, after Rosenblum, the Alaska Supreme Court decided the case of West versus Northern Publishing Company. In West versus Northern Publishing Company, the Alaska Supreme Court applied Rosenblum, which says, again, that the New York Times rule extends to private persons in matters of public concern. Okay, subsequent to West, the Supreme Court of the United States again considered the question and backed away from the Rosenblum rule. What they in Gertz versus Robert Welch, Inc., they rejected the plurality in Rosenblum, i.e. the private person's public question protection of New York Times, and went back to public figures and public officials. Alaska has never had the opportunity, has never ruled subsequent to Gertz or subsequent to West versus Northern Publishing Company. So the rule in Alaska is probably still the Rosenblum rule, i.e., private persons, matters of public or general concern. The situation is a little bit more complicated in Alaska because the Alaska Constitution has a provision which states specifically that every person may freely speak, write, and publish on all subjects, being responsible for the abuse of that right. Two things there. Every person may freely speak, write, and publish. Okay, being responsible for abuse. Okay, now abuse is defined, not specifically, but the best definition you can get for abuse is the definition from New York Times versus Sullivan. You abuse the right of publication if you know the matter to be false or act in reckless disregard as to the truth or falsity. And this is the logical result. So in Alaska, every person may freely speak, write, and publish. So under the Constitution, you presumably have a New York Times rule, which is not limited to public officials or is not limited to media defendants. It's limited to any person speaking on any subject. Supreme Court has never said this. The Supreme Court had an opportunity to say this in the case which is cited in the supplement of Urethane Specialties versus City of Valdez, page 3 of the supplement. The Supreme Court did not have to get to the constitutional issues here because the Supreme Court decided the case based on conditional privilege. In this case, the Supreme Court said a number of things. Truth is, in Alaska, a complete defense to libel actions. In some areas, there is an exception where even though the matter stated may be true, the matter was published or stated with malice. There, in some places, there's a malice exception to the defense of truth. In Alaska, the malice defense exception to the defense of truth was recognized as existing in certain jurisdictions, and that's recognized in Fairbanks versus Fernando. And it's also talked about in Urethane Specialties versus City of Valdez. But in both cases, it was stated that the facts in the particular cases, there was no showing of malice. So they did not have to discuss whether the malice exception applied. The malice exception is recognized, but not held anywhere to be applicable in the state of Alaska. So I think the rule, as evidenced by the Supreme Court, or stated by the Supreme Court, is truth is a complete defense. Malice exception never ruled on. Intentional interference with contractual relations, 21. I won't say anything more about that, except take a look at the case of Alyeska versus Aurora Air Service, which is the supplement on page 1, first case. The only reason that that might be asked is that it was a new case, 1980. The five elements of a prima facie case of intentional interference with contract rights are set forth here. Number 1, valid contract. 2, knowledge of the contract and intent to induce a breach. 3, contract was breached. 4, the breach was caused by wrongful or unjustified conduct. And 5, damages. There are certain privileges to interfere in business relationships, such as to protect your own investments. Moving on. General considerations, survival of causes of action, wrongful death. They're basically self-explanatory. You won't probably be running into these on the bar exam. Only one point which I should make on family relationships. That is that if a spouse sues for loss of consortium, the spouse has to join her suit, normal, let me use the word wife without attempting to be sexist or anything like that. If the wife sues for loss of consortium because her husband is injured, the wife has to join her suit for loss of consortium along with the husband's principal suit. They cannot be brought separately. Discharge of liability on page 24, a special rule in Alaska relating to releases. This Young versus State sets forth another principle which the Alaska Supreme Court has applied from time to time, and that's they have the hard cases make bad law principle, which gets applied, the widow's always win principle, which applies insurance cases. And they had an old rule that if an attorney screws up, we'll bail him out rule. The rule now, being somewhat paranoid, is that if a plaintiff's attorney screws up, we'll bail him out. If a defense attorney screws up, we'll get him. But in any case, in Young versus State, the plaintiff's attorney allowed the release of one joint tortfeasor to be signed, which said that this release releases defendant X as well as all other persons, etc., who may have been responsible for the accident. So naturally, the other joint tortfeasors came in and wanted to take advantage of this release. And the Supreme Court held that regardless of what the release says, the only persons who are released are those persons named in the release. Regardless of what else it says, your name has to be in there in order to get released. This is contrary to the rule in some jurisdictions where a release of one joint tortfeasor as a matter of law operates as a release of all other joint tortfeasors. This case was even worse because there was specific language in the release releasing everybody. But the Supreme Court went and said that you have to be named in the release. Now, in order to avoid this result, the releases are drafted which cite this case. And they say, notwithstanding what it says in Young versus State, we mean that it really does release everybody, regardless of whether they're named or not. And this form, because sometimes you don't know them. You try to name everybody that you know, but sometimes you don't know who the last guy might be. But this type of release, which is drafted now, has not yet been up to the Alaska Supreme Court for any particular ruling. One last major area which we should cover before we leave this evening, and that's the subject of suing the government. Suing the government is a popular hobby among plaintiff's attorneys because the government is involved in so many things that sooner or later you can point the finger at the government for doing something. We start with the State Tort Claims Act. The state waived its immunity against tort lawsuits by virtue of AS 09.50.250. That is available in the statutory supplement. Just take a look at it. The major area which lawsuits against the state have dealt with is the area of the discretionary function exception, i.e., if the state does something which is within its discretion, it's not subject to liability for making a discretionary function decision. If the state is sued for something which is an operational decision, it is liable for negligent operation or negligent acts taken in operational matters. The case which starts this chain is State versus Abbott. State versus Abbott was a case involving the allocation of highway maintenance equipment to certain areas of the particular highway. The state argued that the allocation of this maintenance equipment was a planning level decision, which was an exercise of the discretionary function of the state of Alaska, and consequently was within the discretionary function exception. The Supreme Court rejected this and held that it was an operational decision. Negligence in implementing an operational decision can give rise to liability on the part of the state. The distinction made by State versus Abbott is between planning-level, broad policy decisions, which are within the discretionary function exceptions, and then once the policy has been made, the operational decisions in how to implement the policy, which are not within the discretionary function exception. Now, again, it's kind of hard to ascertain the dividing line between one area and the other area. examples are probably the best things to look at to determine what are discretionary function planning level exceptions and what are operational decisions. The simple one is maintenance of roads. Nor if the state elects, the state has no duty to elect to maintain a particular road. The election to maintain or not to maintain is a planning level decision which is within the discretionary function. Once the state elects to maintain the road, then if it maintains the road negligently, that's operational, and it can be subject to liability for negligent maintenance. Again, negligent design. Once the state elects to, the state is not under any obligation to build a road, but once the state negligently decides to build a road, which is a planning level decision, and negligently designs the road, it can be subject to liability. There are a number of cases involving this question. State versus Janssen, which deals with highway marking. State versus Gwynn, which deals with failure to remove a particular car which was stalled on the Chena Hot Springs Road under ice and snow conditions. Jennings versus State of Alaska, which is a little harder case. Jennings versus State of Alaska, the state decided to build a road, but decided not for, there was a school near the road, and children crossed the road at the school. It was argued that the state should have put in a pedestrian overpass, and it was negligent design as part of the design not to put in a pedestrian overpass. Now, certain types of highway design can be negligent and actionable by the state, but the failure to put a highway overpass or pedestrian overpass so that the pedestrians could walk across the highway was held to be within the discretionary function exception as something which was a planning level matter. Whether or not to build overpasses, whether to or not to designate something as a school zone, whether or not to undertake certain safety measures, are decisions which are governmental decisions which are characterized as planning decisions rather than operational decisions. Now, how this squares with the recently decided case in the supplement of Japan Airlines versus State is somewhat hard to put together. Japan Airlines versus State involved certain design decisions made by the state in construction of a taxiway out of the Anchorage International Airport. Japan Airlines, I don't know if you remember this, had an airplane which was going out the taxiway under a condition of high winds. It was blowing off the taxiway. For negligent design of the taxiway, the state of Alaska could be held liable. That was an operational decision rather than a planning decision. We have a number of cases up before the Alaska Supreme Court right now, and I mean a number. There's three of them at least, which I personally have up there, which deal with the decision as whether or not to put in a traffic light or a stop sign is a planning level decision or an operational level decision. Now, at first blush, it appears that it's an operational level decision, you know, whether or not to mark an intersection with a stop sign or a stop light. But the stop light's cost, the particular stop light that was involved in here, costs $200,000. The state did not have the money to put in a stoplight. There are standards which are to be applied when you by the National Commissioners on Traffic, which determine when you put in a stoplight and when you put on a, in a stop sign, having to do with traffic flow, intersection design, that type of thing. These standards were not satisfied. And the regulation of traffic flow is something which is really a... It's a decision which imposes legal liability and legal responsibilities on particular drivers, and it has an effect on the traffic flow in a particular area. So it arises almost to a legislative type decision. You know, you determine as a matter of law to give one person the right of way and another person no right of way. In this particular case, too, the stoplight would have been put at an intersection which was right over the top of a hill, which would have increased rear-end collisions. There were also additional intersections which had more dangerous things. But basically, this is the next fact situation, which is going to be coming out of the Alaska Supreme Court on discretionary function, the decision whether or not to place stoplights. And that may provide us something, but it won't provide us something before the bar exam. State of Alaska, Adams versus State of Alaska, page 26, talks about the state's liability for negligent failure to enforce fire safety statutes and regulations. Once the state determines to enforce its fire codes, it can be held liable for negligent enforcement. There was another case which was filed at the same time, or generally came down at the same time as Adams versus State. That was a Fairbanks case involving municipal corporations. In State versus Jennings, which was a companion case to Adams, the state had delegated the fire inspection functions to the city of Fairbanks. And there, the city of Fairbanks could also be held liable for negligent inspection. This case, which was a major case involving the destruction of the Nordale Hotel and an incredible amount of property damage and death, resulted in the Alaska Municipal Tort Claims Act, which is also in your supplement, which gives greater protection to the municipalities than the state has under the State Tort Claims Act. I won't discuss it in detail, but it's something you should read. It has a discretionary function exception. It has as a matter of fact, it is worth spending 1 minute on, because I can run through the pertinent points about it. It's AS 09.65.070. It starts with special rules for fire departments. No action may be maintained against an employee or a member of a fire department operated or maintained by a municipality. It has to be a public fire department, because we only have public fire departments here generally. So if it's for a tort or breach of a contractual duty and an exercise of the fire department's function. So fire department exercising its function basically cannot be sued. Okay, then it goes on to no action for damages may be brought against a municipality or any of its agents, officers, or employees. Number one is based on a failure of the municipality when the municipality is not the owner of the property involved to do any of a number of things. Number one, inspect the property for a violation of statute, regulation, or health hazard. Okay, this is what we've got in the Nordale Hotel fire case. If they do inspect it, to discover it. No liability for failure to discover it if an inspection is made. Okay, if you inspect it and discover it and you don't obey it, there's no liability for failure to obey it. Okay? No liability on the municipality if it is not the owner of the property for failure to inspect, failure to discover if you do inspect, or failure to abate if you inspect and discover. Okay, the next one is the exercise or performance of a discretionary function, whether or not the discretion involved is abused. This would be interpreted the same as a discretionary function under the state statute. Number three, which is another common one under which lawsuits used to be brought, is based upon the grant, issuance, refusal, suspension, delay, or denial of any license, permit, appeal, approval, exception, variance, any other entitlement, or a rezoning. There used to be lawsuits for damages alleging that the property was improperly rezoned or they improperly refused to rezone it or improperly exercised some sort of decision of that type. It is possible still to maintain actions of this sort to overturn what was done by the municipality, but it's no longer able to have actions maintained for damages because of what the municipality did, whether or not it abused its discretion. There's another one here which is not common, and that would be the exercise or performance during the course of gratuitous extension of municipal services outside of the city. But basically, just remember here, no claims for fire department activities, failure to inspect, discover, or abate, no actions for exercise of discretionary functions, and no actions for issuance or failure to issue rezonings, licenses, permits, applications, that type of thing. Even where abused in the license permit application situation, right. Special rules, special situations. State-operated school system is an agency of the state of Alaska. University of Alaska is an agency of the state of Alaska. Punitive damages cannot be awarded against the state by statute. Punitive damages cannot be awarded against the University of Alaska because it's an integral part of the state government. So any state or state agency, by state statute, punitive damages cannot be awarded against it. There's no statute against awarding punitive damages against a municipality. The question has been up before the Supreme Court at least twice that I know about, and the Supreme Court has ducked it once, and the case has been settled in the other case. But the argument against awarding punitive damages against a municipality is that you do not really punish the municipal corporation itself for performing the act. Punitive damages are windfall to the plaintiff and for the purpose of punishing the defendant. But the purpose of punishment doesn't work where you're talking about municipal corporations, because you don't punish the municipality, you punish the innocent taxpayer who has to pay the taxes to pay the punitive damage award, and the taxpayer had absolutely nothing to do with what happened. The authority on this from other jurisdictions is split. Some jurisdictions say, yes, punitive damages cannot be awarded against municipalities, both as a matter of statute and as a matter of case law. Other jurisdictions allow punitive damages against municipalities. We've worked our way through everything I have here. I would advise you to take a look at the areas of products liability and take a look at some of the statutes. Long-arm jurisdiction, contribution among joint tortfeasors, offers of judgment, actions against municipalities. If there are any further questions, I'm available after the course tonight. Good luck.
Our client ended up becoming a tenant with the wife because we executed on the husband's interest. That's what we had a claim of. I'll never forget Brian Farney, who's now one of the partners, but was then a law clerk, called the state troopers because we were going to get a writ of assistance to go out and you know, change the locks and guard our locksmith and everything. And state troopers said, well, will there be anyone at the house? And Brian said, probably only the French maid and governess. And there was this dead silence on the other end of the line, and the state troopers said, this is not your average execution, is it? Brian said, no, not quite. And so... that's basically the ballgame, folks. I can't think of anything else. I hope I haven't led you too far astray. Any questions? Yes, sir.
You said, if you recorded a judgment against his property and subsequently became, let's say, a husband today, himself and his wife in the entirety, your judgment would be to full extent.
It would be on the property, and it would be as to his interest in that property.
In other words, she would still have a half interest.
Right. But it's an undivided half interest in the whole, as opposed to it's the tenancy by the entirety type interest, okay? See, had he conveyed the property to her prior to the recording of the judgment, the conveyance to her would have been superior. And with regards to a house, it's very difficult. I mean, what the court will do is they'll say, I'm sorry, the judgment land is ineffective as to that residence. Since he conveyed it subject to the judgment, we wound up owning his interest. It wound up being us and her owning the house. We wiped out his interest. Had he conveyed it to her prior to our judgment, the court would have said, you cannot do that as to a residence because it's not divisible. Okay? So her interest would stay intact. He would have to have the consent of the other party is what happened.
But in other words, it doesn't like convert it into a joint tenant.
Right.
Still has some interest in that.
Right. Anything else? Good luck. Hope to see all your names on the list of people who did it. In the pond.